Sudan against the grain, agriculture in the Soviet Union had some colossal disasters, not the least of which was the near destruction of the Aral Sea, and some significant successes as well. But most of the analysis of that experience has been seen through a Cold War lens. I'm Sasha Lilly, historian Jenny Lee Smith joins me to talk about Soviet agriculture. She argues that it compares decently to other mid-century industrialized agricultural systems, including that of the United States, which of course may not be saying much. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If we hear anything about the history of Soviet agriculture, it's a pretty bleak picture. A story of unchecked environmental destruction, enormous waste and inefficiency, and the oppression of the people involved in it. The underlying message is often that attempts to organize agriculture differently is a utopian dream doomed to failure. In Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963, which is published by Yale University Press, historian of technology and the environment Jenny Lee Smith takes a fresh look at the experience of Soviet agriculture, which spanned 10 time zones and numerous climates and ecosystems. She examines both its successes and dismal failures and situates it next to other 20th century industrialized agriculture systems. She teaches in the School of History and Sociology at Georgia Institute of Technology, and she joins me now. Jenny, if we hear anything about the history of Soviet agriculture, it's of unmitigated failure. Where does that idea, that reigning assessment, come from?
Well, it's not wholly inaccurate. There were a lot of problems with the Soviet system, and there were a lot of failures that Soviet agriculture experienced in the roughly 75 years it was sort of up and running. But it's no small feat to have an agricultural system working for 75 years. I mean, every year that you bring in a harvest is sort of a miniature triumph. And the Soviet Union was able to do that successfully more often than not for most of the time that the Soviets were in power. I think that a lot of the impression of failure comes from, you know, it's a remnant of the Cold War, basically. It's just the time period when all of this was unfolding was a time period when the United States felt a lot of competition with the Soviet Union. This is the era of the space race. And I think that that competition really altered the way that the United States looked at Soviet agriculture. They were looking at problems. They were looking for problems rather than looking to see what kinds of solutions the Soviet Union had come up with, or creative workarounds and things like that. So I think that's really part of that impression is a leftover from the Cold War period.
And one of the things that you argue in your book is that there are actually many more commonalities between the United States and the Soviet experience in terms of industrialized agriculture than one might assume. But their origins, the origins of the Soviet agriculture experience, is of course very different than that of the United States. And so I wonder if you could tell us what the Russian Empire looked like on the eve of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something I write about, that the Soviet Union really comes from rural origins. So as the Bolsheviks are coming to power in 1917 and then during the Civil War period, this is a country that's 80 or 90% peasants, really, people living on the land who make their living as farmers. Many of them are very poor. Many of them are illiterate. One of the statistics I have in my book is that there's more cattle and oxen registered in Russia than there are people in most communities. And Russia is not a place that's known for having a huge supply of cows and oxen. So that's saying something about the kind of rural, the rural life that people are living here. And the Bolsheviks really had to contend with that. They had to, this was what they built their industrialized society out of, was this kind of agrarian, somewhat, I don't really want to use the word backward, but it definitely wasn't, a cutting edge society the way that perhaps the wealthier countries in Western Europe were in the 1917 period.
How did the Bolsheviks think of the countryside and think of the role of agriculture in their project?
Well, they didn't think about it very hard at the beginning. I think when the Bolsheviks came into power, they were very idealistic, and their first focus was sort of on workers and the proletarians who were behind the movement with them. But, you know, agriculture is how people get food. And during the Civil War, especially 1921 and 1922, these were very hungry years in the new Soviet Union. And so the Bolsheviks had to start thinking about agriculture pretty much right away, and how they were going to sort of persuade, you know, the average new Soviet peasant to get on board with their programs and their projects. So they started thinking about it right away. They tried several different tactics for persuading these people that they should be producing food for the Bolsheviks. For most of the 1920s, they left farmers alone. Taxes were pretty low, and farmers were allowed to sell their surplus on the open market. It didn't look much like what we understand communism to be today. And then Stalin comes into power, and the 1930s are a different story. He's much more of a whip than a carrot guy, you could say. He's really Stalin is interested in forcing the Soviet, I still think the right word is peasantry, well into the 1930s, but he's really interested in forcing the Soviet peasantry to go along with state building projects. And that's when you see collectivization, that's when you see a really massive famine, which is essentially a second civil war that Stalin launches on the countryside in the early 1930s to sort of get these parts of the country on board with the, you know, as you said, the urban Bolsheviks' original vision of communism.
Well, you start your study of Soviet agriculture in 1930, so that's the year after Stalin's forced collectivization. And I wonder if you could just explain to us what collectivization entailed.
Sure. So collectivization was several different things in different parts of the country. It happened on paper first. The Bolsheviks were really sort of famous for making bold declarations and turning them into laws, and then sort of distorting the statistics and the newspaper reporting and things like that to make it seem like everything had already happened. You know, any law that they had enacted, it was already working perfectly. And so you see this happening with collectivization, with orders to collectivize the farms. Collectivizing the farms, I think before I started this study, I had a really different idea of what it meant to collectivize a farm. I guess I thought it was a more hands-on process where somehow the Soviet state went into the countryside and sort of created these great big, you know, maybe 10,000 acre farms and put in big barns and huge new state-run facilities. That's not really what happened at all. Collectivization, you know, first it happens on paper, and then the Soviets, you know, they do go into villages and get people in the villages to sort of sign up for the collective farm, often sort of by hook or by crook. They hold a big community meeting, and then people are sort of strongly urged, strongly encouraged, maybe because there's a Bolshevik official in the back of the room with a large gun to sign up on the collective farm. But then very little else really happens. People go back to their houses. There aren't any new facilities that are built. Maybe the Bolsheviks will take over, the former church. This is a period when they're beginning to really crack down on religion, and they'll turn a village church into sort of a collective farm headquarters where they'll house a couple of bookkeepers or something like that. But the look and the feel of the countryside doesn't change much in this period. The Bolsheviks are really eager to get the countryside mechanized with machines like tractors and combine harvesters. They're really eager to have peasants combine their fields into great big wheat fields instead of little tiny plots of land. But all of those things really come later. It's a slow process. It doesn't really happen overnight, except on paper, basically.
And how do those peasants react to these changes, especially as with time, the process moves ahead?
Well, different people reacted in different ways. Some peasants were really interested in being part of the collectivization program. They were in a minority, but I would say especially somewhat wealthier communities that were close to major metropolitan areas like Moscow or like Leningrad, present-day St. Petersburg. These were people who were often kind of on board with this whole process. People in the farther away places, what you might want to call the hinterlands of the Soviet Union, places in Ukraine or places that were pretty distant from these cities, were much more reluctant, especially in communities that had previously sort of had some kind of history of resistance or problems with the state, or who had gone reluctantly with the Bolsheviks and Soviet power rather than remaining independent at the time of the Civil War. These were people who really wanted to be left alone by the state, had been very grateful for that sort of breathing space that was there in the 1920s, and were not eager at all to go back to a more top-down, heavy-handed form of government, which was really what collectivization promised at this time. So it really varied, but there were definitely, if you look at a map geographically, there's sort of hotbeds of resistance, and they tend to be away from cities, and they tend to be in places like Ukraine, places that have a really strong ethnic identity or nationalist identity that at this time was still very separate from the Soviet identity.
You argue that the Soviet definition of agricultural progress and the methods that were used to achieve that progress changed over time. And I wonder if you could talk about what those ideals were in the 1930s.
Progress in the 1930s in the Soviet Union really meant tractors. There were probably some other measures, but the Soviet Union was very focused on machines and heavy industry, and it really meant bringing more machines and better machines to the fields. In my book, I write about a farm that doesn't have any tractors at all in 1930. This is a small pig farm in a village Ivanova, which is up in the north of the Soviet Union, not too far away from present-day St. Petersburg, I guess. And you know, places that weren't getting tractors were really getting left behind in some ways. They were interested in participating in collective endeavors, but they, you know, they were often sort of a second tier group. The village I write about, the Soviet Union decides that they should have pigs instead, and so they hire all of these pig experts to come in, and you know, they're getting money and resources from the state to raise pigs. The state is trying hard to turn this into an industrial operation. But really, the Soviet Union is much better with machines than it is with animals. That's one of the points of my book, is really that it does a good job getting heavy machines onto farms. It doesn't do such a great job increasing the size or productivity or survival rate of animals like pigs, of agricultural animals at this time.
I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Jenny Lee Smith, author of Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. You, Jenny, were just talking about machinery and how that fitted in with the Soviets' notion of progress. How did the Soviets judge their not only their notion of success, but just their ideal about what industrialized agriculture should look like, in contrast to the United States, both a rival and in some ways a model?
Well, the Soviets really idolized American agriculture. I think most of the world did, especially in the 1930s, but this remains true in the post-war period as well. Agriculture in the U.S. is a little special, in part because the United States has a really temperate climate, and we also have, you know, as Americans, we've had a lot of industrial progress happen really rapidly, especially in the realm of agriculture. In the Soviet Union, that wasn't true, and so the Soviets look to the U.S. as a model. They import tractor plans from the United States. In fact, Henry Ford actually has a contract to produce tractors in the Soviet Union in the late 1920s. They look at plans for things like pig farms, and they also import animal stock. So prize-winning pigs in the United States might get shipped over, purchased by the Soviet Union in the period just before World War II. After World War II, the United States makes much of that kind of purchasing illegal. But before the war, there's quite a bit of that going on. The Soviets are trying really hard to learn from and borrow and adopt American-style agriculture. They plan to sort of impose a socialist ideology on that agriculture, but they're really interested in, you know, they believe in the American model of success, and they want to emulate that, basically. They want to imitate that on their own soil.
Well, a huge blow to Soviet agriculture and, of course, to Soviet society in general was World War II, which was particularly devastating for the Soviet Union. How did World War II affect on the ground Soviet agriculture and then also create a kind of a break between the pre-war period and the post-war period in terms of Soviet planning and policy?
It was really a difference of night and day. One of the other things I learned in the course of this project, and you know, I think a lot of historians realize this eventually, but you just can't overstate the level of devastation that the Soviet Union experienced during World War II. It was really tremendous. I think for most, the American experience of World War II was one of a loss of thousands of soldiers, and it was, you know, tragic, but you know, in the Soviet Union, this is a loss of tens of millions of people in the war. This was especially devastating for agriculture. The Soviet Union, you know, was invaded by the German army, and it was occupied for most of the war by the German army. So these lands that the Germans took over were the most agriculturally productive parts of the Soviet Union. And so during the war, the Soviet Union was cut off from sort of its heartlands. And there was also a lot of devastation. Stalin adopted what was called a scorched earth campaign, where as people retreated in the face of the German army, they were supposed to burn not only their fields, but to destroy their machinery and their barns and things like that. So when people were moving back into places in Ukraine and southern Russia at the end of World War II, it really wasn't a matter of starting over. It was a matter of starting from nothing. There was almost nothing left to sort of build up from. This was both a blessing and a curse. People were able to start new, to build and change agriculture in some really interesting ways in the post-war period. But there were a lot of people who also chose not to go back into agriculture, to not move back to the collective farms at the end of the war, because it was just, the devastation was just too great, and it was just too hard to do that, to completely rebuild their lives.
Did that shift in any way the pre-war focus on machinery as being the ultimate focus of agriculture, since obviously following the war, so much of that had been destroyed?
Yeah, so after the war, the Soviets still really love their machines. That never really goes away. But they do get more and more interested in animals and improving animal agriculture. And this isn't just the Soviets. I mean, I trace this out in the Soviet Union. But you see this as sort of a global fixation in this Cold War period, that the United States, Great Britain, France, many countries are very interested in boosting animal production and encouraging people to eat more meat and making more meat cheaper and more available to people as a way to sort of prove their success in agriculture and their sort of level of civilization and sophistication. So this is not lost on the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is doing the same thing. They are also trying to boost productivity in animal agriculture. And so this is sort of a different focus. We go from struggling pig farms that the Soviet Union kind of gives up on in the 1930s to a real push in the 40s and 50s for improving every level of animal agriculture and you know, charting out how much more meat and milk Soviet citizens are having access to, you know, on a year-by-year basis.
And how did that influence the way that the general public, Soviet public, saw the state? Did it have a sense that if the availability of meat and dairy had increased, that they were in a society that was looking after them more than in the past, where famine was a real danger?
To some extent, yes. I think that, you know, this definition is created in part because meat has always been a marker of wealth, and people who have access to meat historically have always been the richest people, the most upper class people in a society. And one of the promises of modern society is that everyday workers can have access to those same kinds of luxuries, that those things that were once scarce are suddenly available to all. So I think that's really where it comes from, is just this historic idea that meat is, you know, the best thing out there. I think that gets exploited during the Cold War. And I think the United States really starts this competition in many ways, because the United States knows that it has a superior agricultural system. That has a lot more to do with, you know, how much of the U.S.'s agricultural system is in a temperate zone, how long their growing season is, and things like that. But the U.S. knows it can kind of win this game. It's always going to look more productive. It's always going to be yielding, you know, larger cows and fatter pigs and things like that, simply because it's a warmer climate. The animals tend to be larger and thrive more in temperate zones, and they tend to struggle and be smaller in colder places. And the Soviet Union had an awful lot of cold places, so it couldn't necessarily compete on size, at least, with the United States. It certainly tried to compete in terms of scale, and it came up with some creative ways for measuring what counts as a meat product or a milk product during these years. But for the most part, it knew that it was always going to sort of be second to the United States without some creative accounting taken in place.
Jenny Smith, you write in your book, Works in Progress, that following World War II, the Soviet Union, Soviet planners shifted their approach to agriculture to focus particularly on the idea of the human control over nature. And I wonder if you could talk about something you just touched on, which is the nature, the environment, or really many environments that one found across the vast expanse of the Soviet Union. To what degree did that pose challenges that were unique to the Soviet Union, and how did that fit in with this idea of controlling nature?
The environment is not quite everything in agriculture, but it sure is a lot. And it won't surprise anyone in your audience to learn that the Soviet Union was a pretty cold place comparatively, more on scale with Canada probably than the United States. But if you look at the productivity of the Soviet Union, they're really trying to compete with the United States in terms of agricultural productivity. The Soviet Union is huge, and so it has a really varied climate. There's definitely parts of the Soviet Union, or there were parts of the Soviet Union where, you know, that are semi-tropical, that grew, you know, dates and things like that. But there is an awful lot of the Soviet Union that is tundra and steppe land and very marginal for agriculture. These are places with extremely short growing seasons. I don't think I mentioned it in the book, but there are stories about Siberian farmers. One of their jobs was actually to go and sweep the snow off of the fields before they planted their grain, just to get a couple of extra days. If they got the snow off of it, then the sun would shine down on the earth and warm it up so that the soil would unfreeze just a few days earlier, which was important for productivity in these marginal climates. So those are the kinds of climates that the Soviets are trying to deal with. They adopt a lot of different kinds of strategies to sort of try to overcome the environment during this period. And I think the important thing to remember here, I mean, hearing about the strategies is fascinating, but the important thing to remember is that they really thought they could overcome the environment, that by employing technology, by employing a huge army of agricultural workers, they would be able to sort of rise above the fact that they were in such a northern climate. They would be able to have the world's best agricultural system. So the Soviet Union was very idealistic in this, in thinking that they sort of had inherited, an empire without limits, without the same kinds of biological limits that I think maybe people today are recognizing are much less flexible than perhaps two or three generations back we assumed them to be. And again, I think that's been sort of a global and collective realization that there really are some hard and fast limits, that it's not especially profitable or worthwhile to try to get around in agriculture.
Well, one of the places that you could call it idealism or perhaps hubris comes to play in this story is around the influence of the pseudoscientific ideas of the Soviet biologist and agronomist Trofim Lysenko. I wonder if you could tell us the thrust of his ideas and then the interesting story of how they were applied in practice in Soviet agriculture.
So I think Lysenko is a little bit famous in this country. Perhaps some people have heard of him as a sort of 20th century Lamarckian. So he essentially became famous for believing in a theory of acquired characteristics. He was a plant biologist working in the 19-teens and 1920s in the new Soviet Union. And he was kind of a guy who was in the right place at the right time. So he's from very humble origins. And he was a true believer, at least at the beginning, in the Soviet system, and he really benefited by it. He sort of launched a very successful career. At some point, however, you know, he becomes quite a careerist. He's a very ambitious guy, and he begins sort of, you know, proselytizing, maybe is a good word, but spreading the word of bad science, essentially. And most of his ideas are kind of related to communism, the idea that, you know, a plant can overcome hardship, it can overcome a bad climate or an unfriendly beginning, and it can learn to thrive if the right kind of attention is paid to it. This was something that he wrote about for both plants and animals, and his theories were applied widely in the post-war period, largely because the Soviet Union really wanted to increase its productivity. In the field of plant agriculture, Lysenko's theories were really devastating. They were responsible for a number of different crop failures that have been really well documented. And I definitely don't want to take away from the idea that he was a charlatan, essentially, and that he was offering bad science as a way to sort of advance himself politically within the Soviet system. What was interesting to me and what I write about in Works in Progress is that these same ideas applied in animal agriculture actually don't represent a huge failure. A lot of his suggestions of nurturing animals when they are very young, of improving their feed so that they will grow bigger and stronger and have bigger and stronger babies, a lot of those things actually work. It turns out that if you do pay extra close attention to animals very early in life, regardless of their genetics, they do tend to have a higher survival rate. If you make sure to fatten them up before you breed them, they tend to have heavier babies when they do give birth. And so these facts actually ended up sort of making it look like Lysenko knew what he was talking about during this period. So one of the ongoing mysteries of Lysenkoism is that it didn't take people very long to figure out that Lamarckianism didn't work very well. But Lysenko was around in the Soviet Union for a really long time. He rises to power in the 1930s, but he stays in power well into the 1950s. His fall doesn't happen until Khrushchev is ousted as premier of the Soviet Union in the early 1960s. So I really think that the success he experienced with animal agriculture in changing policies to reflect sort of Lysenkoist ideals, and the fact that this was one of the first times the Soviets really did have success in improving their population rate with animals, I think this is, you know, I think you can tie these two things together, that this is one of the reasons Lysenko was around for as long as he was.
Historian of technology and the environment, Jenny Smith is my guest. We'll return with her in just a moment.
Thank you.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today we're talking about the environmental and social lessons to be learned from a mid-century industrialized agricultural system. No, not the United States, but that of the Soviet Union. I'm joined by Jenny Lee Smith. She is a historian of technology and the environment, and we're discussing her book, Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. That's published by Yale University Press. As you alluded to before the break, Khrushchev came to power in 1956. He did so following the death of Stalin in 1953. And he himself was from peasant origins, rural origins. Under his tenure, how did Soviet planning change regarding agriculture?
Well, Khrushchev really came to power wanting to make a mark in agriculture, wanting to improve productivity. And this was one of the focuses of his years in office. As you said, he was from a rural background, and unlike Stalin, he was very interested in bringing real progress and real change to the rural Soviet Union. That's not to say that he was especially effective at doing that, but he did start out with intentions to go in that direction. Khrushchev was often called a kukuruznik. He was very interested in corn. And one of the sort of ongoing jokes, I think if people know something about Khrushchev, they might know that he tries to get corn to grow in very cold parts of the Soviet Union, in Siberia and Kazakhstan. And this is true, but Khrushchev is not trying to convince Soviet citizens that they should eat corn, and he's not trying to get the corn to ripen amazingly fast. What he's doing is he's raising this corn so that they can feed it to pigs and cows. This is meant to be a new fodder crop for the Soviet Union. And when you feed corn to animals, you don't need it to be ripe at all. So the fact that corn really never turns yellow on the ear as it's growing in these very cold climates is secondary. It's providing a brand new source of feed for a new generation of animals. Khrushchev and one of his ministers, Anastas Mikoyan, were both really interested in using things like feed crops and biological technologies to sort of improve the performance of animals, to make bigger animals, to have more, you know, baby piglets every year, things like that. So he was very enthusiastic about these projects. That enthusiasm was also part of his downfall. He was absolutely certain that these things were going to succeed, and when they didn't, year after year, you know, the people around him began to lose faith in him. And one of the main reasons for him stepping down from power in, I believe it was 1963, he leaves office, is because of this loss of faith, because he sort of promised big changes in agriculture, and he's attempted to make these things happen. He has a number of different agricultural campaigns, but ultimately none of them are runaway successes. None of them deliver what he has promised they're going to deliver.
What was his Virgin Lands campaign?
So the Virgin Lands campaign was a campaign to populate and plow up big chunks of Kazakhstan and southern Siberia, the far east of the Soviet Union. And this was a campaign he implemented in the 1950s as a way to expand agriculture in the Soviet Union. And again, the reason he's interested in expanding, and specifically fields. So he wants to expand the number of fields and the acreage of grain in the Soviet Union. He wants to do this. This grain is earmarked for animals, for the most part. Most of this new land is creating feed and fodder crops for animals. It's not very successful. The first few years are successful, but it has a And other scholars have pointed this out. Other historians have noted that the Virgin Lands campaign has an unhappy ending, not that dissimilar to what happens in the United States during the Dust Bowl. So after these steppe lands, this prairie essentially is plowed up and planted with corn and other feed crops for a number of years, the first few years are pretty successful because that rich land still has a lot of nutrients in it. But it is also very prone to erosion, and so you see dust storms and a lot of this topsoil just blowing away in this period, which results in huge losses throughout the 1960s, actually, for these regions and many of these virgin lands that were sort of planned and carried out. Ultimately, don't end up lasting for more than 10 or 20 years. They do not become permanent settlements. Essentially, they're failures of the campaign.
We've been speaking a lot about the role that Soviet agriculture played in domestic politics, but what about the geopolitical side of Soviet agriculture? How important was it in the race against the United States through various indices of trying to show success or superiority as a social system?
Well, I think that the Soviet Union, for a period, was in more or less direct competition with the United States. Khrushchev is famous for the phrase that they will catch up and overtake the United States in agricultural production. But in fact, if you look at their actual policies, Khrushchev was an idealist, but he also implemented, especially in the realm of sort of food rather than agriculture, so processed agricultural products, he implements a lot of very realistic strategies to make sure that people in the Soviet Union have enough, to make sure that there won't be devastating famines, that everybody will have access to plenty of calories and even some fun treats every once in a while, like chocolate and ice cream. But you know, I think there's a general acknowledgement that it will take the Soviet Union quite a while, and maybe never. I'm not sure if that's ever said out loud at any Politburo meetings, but it will take the Soviet Union quite a while to be at the level of the United States. That the most important thing is to make sure that people don't feel like they are making a sacrifice by living in the Soviet Union, to make sure that people feel comfortable, they feel well-fed, they feel like they have an access to a variety and a range of products, and that things are getting better rather than worse. I think those are the priorities of this period. So the official rhetoric is one of catch up and overtake, but on the ground things play out a little differently. The food technologists of the Soviet Union are realists, and they improve the Soviet food supply, but they don't necessarily plan on having nearly as many surplus calories or the same level of meat or milk that Americans had access to during this same time.
How important were agricultural exports for the Soviet Union, both in terms of self-image, but also in terms of bringing cash into the Soviet economy?
Well, it varies a lot over time. The Soviet Union leaned pretty heavily on exports of wheat, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s. In the post-war period, these are important to a certain extent, but you know, in the 20s and 30s, the United States is buying some of that wheat. In the post-war period, the United States is not doing any kind of agricultural trade with the Soviet Union. So agricultural exports are less economically central and a little bit more symbolic. So the Soviet Union, for example, sets up a big trade scheme with Cuba, for example, where Cuba sends the Soviet Union sugar, and the Soviet Union sends Cuba mostly wheat, but other grains as well. So that's sort of the classic kind of Cold War era trade agreement that the Soviet Union set up, where they are sort of in solidarity and supporting another communist or socialist state, essentially, and supporting its economy.
The program's Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Jenny Lee Smith about her book, Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. Your story ends, as the title of your book indicates, with the Soviet Union's first major purchase of wheat on the world market, which is wheat from the United States. What led to that point, and how was that received by the Soviet public?
I end in 1963 because this is the first time the Soviet Union does this. The most famous time the Soviet Union purchases wheat from the United States is later. It's in the 70s, 1972. The Great Grain Robbery is an event where this happens. It's very public, And this happens at an especially bad moment during the Cold War, and it's sort of perceived that the Soviet Union has sort of gotten away with something, and that the United States was accidentally tricked into selling its wheat at a low price to the Soviets. One of the reasons I stop in 1963 instead of going all the way to 1972 is just because the Soviet Union started buying wheat in 1963 and had been quietly doing so for most of the other years in the 1960s, on and off. There were some good years where they didn't need to buy wheat on the international market, but for the most part, they were becoming an importer rather than an exporter of wheat during this period. In 1963, this was a non-event in the United States, but for Soviet citizens, this was pretty scarring. And this really led to Khrushchev's downfall. One of the reasons they bought wheat on the market was this was because there had been yet another harvest failure, crop failure in the heartlands of the Soviet Union. And so this was seen as yet another failure on the part of Khrushchev to deliver on his promises of increasing agricultural production throughout the country. So that was really how it was read by Soviet citizens to some extent, but especially to political outsiders, the people who were actually making the decision to throw Khrushchev out of power. The Soviet Union, of course, was calling itself a democracy at this time, but it was not as if Khrushchev was voted out. There was essentially a sort of benevolent coup that took him out of power in 1963, but this was definitely one of the big events that contributed to his ouster at this time.
Well, let's talk about your assessment of the Soviet experience in agriculture, which, as you narrate in your book, changed over time. You say it's very difficult to sort of assess things in terms of simply success or failure, but let me ask you to start by talking about perhaps the most glaring legacy, which was to the environment. What were the ecological consequences of industrialized Soviet agriculture?
It's hard to overestimate them in some places in the Soviet Union. I know, for example, cotton farming in Central Asia, for example, has been this contributed to the death of the Aral Sea, and has been absolutely devastating for both humans who live there and for the environment. I mean, it's essentially becoming a dead space in some ways, and that is definitely part of the Soviet legacy. There was also an incredible amount of waste in Soviet agriculture. So I think this is true in most agricultural systems, but the Soviet Union, the waste level is pretty appalling. Part of this is because, you know, lack of refrigeration or a lack of organization, the sort of command and control methods that the Soviet Union used to ship food around the country or to supply orders to one factory or another factory just led to things like, you know, shipments of fruit rotting in trains and things like that. So it was a highly inefficient system. In defense of the Soviet system, if I may very briefly, it does not compare that badly with the American system, both in terms of waste, but also the Soviet system, partially because they're not especially good at distributing a lot of different kinds of inputs. They never really invest heavily in fertilizers, for example, until very late in the Soviet Union. So for most of this time period, agricultural workers are not spreading, you know, petroleum-based fertilizers across their fields, for example. So there are some ways in which the sort of dysfunctionality of the Soviet system actually serves as something of an environmental protectant. I don't want to say that's always the case at all times, but if you compare Soviet industrialized agriculture to that of other countries, you come up with some interesting case studies where there really are some advantages to their system being a little bit backwards or a little bit behind the times.
Well, what about the things that you saw as conscious innovations? That, in a sense, is almost an accident, because as you write in your book, had they had access to those fertilizers or antibiotics for farm animals, for example, that they probably would have used them following the model they were going on, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is not a you know, this is, I mean, it's a bit like Cuban agriculture today. There's no conscious choice to not use fertilizers and pesticides. They just don't have access to these things, so they're not able to use them. So the protective qualities that this has is simply, you know, you can look at it as a form of poverty in the Soviet system, or an oversight in the sort of tiers of development that they're building up as time goes on.
So over a 30-year period, the Soviet Union went from being a very economically underdeveloped, primarily rural country, to an industrialized country, which was an imperial power, which raised the standard of living for the majority of its population. Obviously, that's a mixed legacy in all sorts of ways, but I wonder if you could talk about, looking at agriculture, what you think were the successes over that period of time, and even the innovations that planners were often seen through the lens of the Cold War as being totally misguided, wasteful, foolish, the ways they coped with the kind of challenges that Soviet agriculture faced.
I mean, I would say that the Soviet Union managed to exploit some of its best resources, which were human resources, and that once it realized that, you know, it shouldn't treat the millions and millions of people living in agricultural parts of the Soviet Union as liabilities, but should treat them as an asset, I think that's when the system itself really started to thrive. So you see the Soviet Union turning more towards labor-intensive kinds of agriculture in the 1950s and really even into the 1960s. And in part, this is because of the total devastation of World War II. They really don't have a choice. They don't have machines to fall back on. They don't have machines to replace human labor. But once they do that, there's sort of a cascade of changes. I mean, first of all, they tend to value some of these kinds of work that had perhaps not been so highly valued before. And so people are earning at least slightly better wages, and they're also sort of the virtues of their jobs are being extolled. These also become a way for the Soviet Union to keep better track of its animals and its progress. So one of the things you see a lot of in the 1930s and 1940s is Soviet officials kind of cooking the books. Part of that reason is because there are a lot of people in rural areas dying in the 1930s especially. But even without considering the terrible famine years, there's still, you know, a way in which Soviet officials really don't have a great grasp on what's going on in the countryside. In the 50s and 60s, they sort of come back to the countryside with new eyes and new kinds of ideas about how to manage rural residents and how to best take advantage of them as workers. And that works to their advantage in this period. And it does help to significantly boost the productivity of Soviet agriculture in this period. And it does it without the kind of, you know, terror and civil war that Stalin imposed during the years right after collectivization in the early 1930s. And it does it without resorting to the kind of laissez-faire proto-capitalist system that was in place in the 1920s. So that was one of the main points I wanted to make with this book was simply that that's that is a real achievement, and the Soviet agricultural system has many problems, but that's one thing that I think we can look at and learn from and recognize as a true achievement, their interest in the people on the ground and being able to take advantage of them in the best way.
Well, obviously the Soviet Union is no more. What lessons do you think we can draw from the Soviet experience today in thinking about industrialized agriculture, whether it's in the Soviet Union or elsewhere?
Well, let's see. You know, I'm a historian, so I don't get asked questions like this an awful lot. But I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, I work in Russia now. It's been a few years since I've been back, but I have spent a fair amount of time there visiting archives and different cities and things like that. And I have to say that I don't know if people are exactly nostalgic for the Soviet state, but there is a way in which an heavy-handed, imposing state, especially the kind that Khrushchev maybe was in charge of in the 50s and 60s, takes better care of rural people, people living outside of big fashionable cities. So there's a way in which some people in the Soviet Union were better taken care of during Soviet times than they are now during Russian times. There's a way in which because the state is smaller, because it's less concerned with, you know, you don't collect your paycheck from the government. You know, there's a lot more private industry in Russia today. But there are a lot more people who have fallen through the cracks. There are a lot more elders who depend on their neighbors to put sacks of buckwheat in front of their apartment doors once a week to help them to help them get enough to eat and things like that. There are a lot of people who've fallen through the cracks in the Russian system. And I don't think people are nostalgic necessarily for the Soviet period, but I do think there is a way in which the Soviet period, especially with food and agriculture, did pay close attention to sort of doing right by its citizens, especially in these post-war years that I focus on.
Jenny Lee Smith has been my guest. She is a historian of technology and the environment. She teaches in the School of History and Sociology at Georgia Institute of Technology. And her book, which we've been discussing in this hour, is Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. That's published by Yale University Press. Jenny Lee Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much, Sasha. I enjoyed talking to you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for joining us, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.